Blog Talk Radio.
Program for job seekers out of work 6 months or longer. The
program expires at the end of the year. Christine Owens, director of the National Employment Law, says if long-term jobless aid ends, the basic economic security floor will be ripped from under 2 million unemployed workers. Families depending on unemployment insurance to get by are probably already cutting back, knowing that the benefits may not be there next year. Losing this lifeline during the holiday season will be devastating to individuals and families for whom federal benefits provide a small measure of economic security and a crucial bridge to reemployment. Both Owen and AFL-CIO President Richard Trumka said the drop in the jobless rate to 7.7 announced today is good news, but it can't overshadow the huge problem of the nearly 5 million long-term unemployed workers. Even with renewed job growth in recent months, we remain years away from regaining all the jobs lost during the Bush recession and financial crisis. Extending unemployment insurance to protect a lifeline for unemployed workers is critical. Owens notes that the economic impact of allowing the long-term jobless help to expire goes beyond the pain it would cause individual families. The corresponding reduction in consumption resulting from the cutoff of benefits threaten an already fragile recovery. It would, according to NELP, reduce economic growth by $48 billion next year, resulting in a loss of hundreds of thousands of jobs. Eliminating federal unemployment insurance benefits would cost retailers alone more than $16 billion in 2013. The cutoff would leave the unemployed with no further jobless aid beyond the 26 weeks states typically provide, even though the average unemployed worker is out of work for roughly 40 weeks, and there are more than three unemployed workers for every one job opening. So, pretty sad. He said you can find out more in this fact sheet from NELP on the looming expiration of federal employment insurance. You just look at the fact sheet for a second and see what's on it. There really aren't that many voices out there trying to bring some kind of reason or rhyme to what's happening to the unions, what's happening to the middle class in the United States. Really pretty sick. But I came across an article here to read it. It's rather a lengthy article, but it was a good one, and it really kind of breaks down how the middle class is being strangled deliberately. And Bear with me, folks. I'm sorry. I lost this article. I'm trying to find it again. Really, really is annoying. I am having a terrible time navigating through this tonight. Why exactly? Do not know why. Sorry, folks. Tell you what, I'm kind of distracted here with this. Why don't I go to a quick music break? And I'll be right back. Let's put a little.
Jordan, the local union financial officer, told
Local 334 in Biddeford, Maine, said workers at the Hostess factory in Biddeford agreed to plow 28 cents of their 30 cents an hour wage increase in November 10 into the pension plan. Hostess was supposed to take the additional 28 cents an hour and contribute it to the workers' pension plan. Employees never saw that 28 cents. In July 2011, Hostess stopped making pension contributions and used the money to run the business. Employees never received the pension funds, and the compensation Hostess promised the workers was not made up in wages either. In all likelihood, the tactic doesn't violate federal law because the money didn't get paid to employees first, but went directly to the pension fund. And lawyers call this situation betrayal without remedy, and it's unlikely the money can be recovered. Hostess CEO Gregory Rayburn's response ranged from understatement to "it's not my fault." All right, Gregory Rayburn, Hostess chief executive officer, said in an interview, "It is terrible that employee wages earmarked for the pension were steered elsewhere by my company." He says, "I think it's like a lot of things in this case." He said, "It's not a good situation to have." Mr. Rayburn became chief executive in March and learned about the issue shortly before the company shut down. He said, "Wherever the circumstances were, whatever those decisions were, I wasn't there," he said. And Rayburn's predecessor at Hostess, Brian Driscoll, refused to comment. The end of pension contributions were a major factor in the Bakers Union's refusal to make a deal with the company. After a U.S. bankruptcy judge granted Hostess' request to impose a new contract, the union's employees went on strike, and Hostess then moved to liquidate the company. The company's cessation of making pension contributions was a critical component of the Bakers' decision to walk off the job. If they had continued to fund the pension, I think we'd still be working there today, said Craig Davis, a 44-year-old forklift operator who loaded trucks with Twinkies, cupcakes, and sweet rolls at an Emporia, Kansas bakery for nearly 22 years. The amount of employee compensation lost by the company is not known, but the numbers are staggering. In 5 months before the last January bankruptcy filing, the company missed payments to the main Baker pension fund totaling $22.1 million. After that, foregone pension payment added up at a rate of $3 million to $4 million a month until Hostess formally rejected its contracts with the union, and the figures include company contributions and employee wages that were earmarked for the pension. So they ripped them off and gave themselves these monster bonuses. I mean, it's unbelievable. I mean, it's just damn unbelievable. But anyway, and that's the way they work. That's the way they are. About this article that I wanted to read was that it broke down the intentions of the long-awaited intentions of the corporations secrecy that this law was passed under, the right to work law, really, really was a dirty deal. Downright dirty deal. And, well, I'll get to that in one second. I'm still... I'm sorry to leave that area, but I am so ticked off that I can't find that. It's an interesting article because so many people are faced with this problem today. The working poor need unions too. Workers at Walmart need public assistance to afford heating their homes. Workers at Wendy's and McDonald's need food stamps to survive. As more and more jobs get shipped overseas, workers in the United States are clinging to the jobs that can't be easily outsourced: food service, domestic care, and retail. People all over the country are taking bold actions to shed light on the poor working conditions that they face. Walmart workers protested on Black Friday, busiest shopping day of the year, and New York City fast food workers from chains like McDonald's and Wendy's went out on a strike as well. The New York Times, Eduardo Porter writes, unionizing the bottom of the pay scale of two workers who on the surface don't have much in common. Jose Carrillo, a 79-year-old Peruvian immigrant from Washington Heights, and Mr. Williams, a 28-year-old single father living with a relative, both need food stamps to make ends meet. They both earn little more than $7 an hour at fast food restaurants. Porter writes, labor unions are hoping that the unusual tactics, often in collaboration with social justice activists and other communist groups, will offer them a new opportunity to get back on the offensive, helping to raise the floor for wages and working conditions in the harsh, ultra-competitive economy of the 21st century. Mr. Carrillo and Mr. Williams' meager salaries also underscore the straightforward choice we face as a nation. Either we build an economy in which most workers can earn enough to adequately support their families, or we build a government with the wherewithal to subsidize the existence of all lower classes that can't survive on its own. We are doing neither. Recently, the National Domestic Workers Alliance released a groundbreaking report that told the stories of America of workers like Anna, who make only $1.38 an hour caring for four children in Midtown Manhattan. Organizing victories for taxi drivers in New York City and car wash workers in Los Angeles are examples of unlikely unions being formed and workers gaining a voice on the job. Low-wage workers or the poor, working poor, are people who work full-time but still struggle to afford food, shelter, and care for their families. Alan Michael Nolan, Gawker's labor editor, writes about the stirrings of a new labor movement. And he says, domestic workers, fast food workers, and retail workers, these are the workers most in need of the help of unions, and the workers least likely to have it. These are the workers with few other options, and like it or not, their ranks will only be growing as our low-wage recovery grinds on. And that jobs may be the future, but let's at least try to make the future livable. And I think that is so true. We hear a lot about the rising Medicare health, you know, or the rising cost of Medicare, and it's really not so much the Medicare that's rising as the public, as the cost of public health, you know. This article attacks that. It says the big debt driver, rising health care costs, not Medicare, and it says that it's by Diane Archer. This is a cross post from the Huffington Post by Diane Archer, former president of the Medicare Rights Center. As both our national debt and health care costs continue to swell, America's CEOs and other influentials have targeted Medicare as a key culprit, and insist that Congress cut Medicare spending in the current deficit discussions. In truth, we do not have a Medicare problem in this country. We have a big problem of rising health care costs. To rein in escalating deficits over the long term, Congress must address the lack of competition in the health care marketplace, which is driving up overall health care costs, including Medicare's. If we are to control health care spending, we need to restructure the private health care market to bring down prices. Cutting Medicare spending without addressing the systemic issue will simply shift the burden of rising health care costs to vulnerable old adults and people with disabilities. It is not a long-term solution for either Medicare or the deficit. The private health care market is not competitive. Despite the claims of prominent true believers, anyone who has taken Economics 101 knows that a competitive market that reigns in costs is incompatible with providers holding monopoly power, as they currently do. Conservative and liberal health policy experts agree that competition is notably absent from our health care market. Large hospital networks tend to dominate most local health care markets, enabling them to set prices with insurers. Insurers profit from this arrangement since higher taxes mean greater cash flow for working capital and higher earnings. And since the largest insurers are generally able to secure most favored nation clause agreements with these hospitals, meaning the hospitals can't change lower rates to smaller insurers, market-dominating insurers create a barrier to entry that impedes competition from other insurers and ensures that provider rates continue rising. Because private health care insurers are unable to control the cost of health care, costs in the commercial market are rising faster than the rate of general inflation, and 2 percentage points faster than Medicare, ballooning private insurance costs in turn drive up Medicare costs more than they would otherwise rise. And over the past 10 years, California inpatient hospitals rates paid by commercial insurers have risen 150%, with 78% to Medicare. Commercial health insurance increases are unsustainable, and they make no sense. In the tiny state of New Jersey, the cost of colonoscopies can be 4 times higher in one place than another. Oregon is seeing a roughly 10% annual increase in the cost of many medical services. If there were competition, you'd expect to see efficiencies in the market and market-based constraints on growing insurance and healthcare costs. But there is no meaningful competition in the market, in the insurance market. Health insurance costs have more than offset wage increases. And for working people over the past 2 decades, in the next decade, an increasing number of people likely will see healthcare costs rise much faster than their wages, meaning that a large number of Americans with serious healthcare needs are likely to go bankrupt. Without the discipline of an active market in health insurance, rising healthcare prices have become a huge piece of the healthcare cost problem. The Healthcare Cost Institute recently managed to get privileged access to health insurance companies' information about rising healthcare spending. The reports reveal that increasingly unit prices, that is, fees paid to hospitals, doctors, and other providers, is the main reason spending is rising from year to year. Of course, Wall Street profits demand profits handsomely from this broken healthcare marketplace, which delivers even higher returns to investors, insurance companies, and healthcare providers. That's why you hear nothing from the CEOs about addressing the real healthcare crisis for working Americans. And their shareholders have nothing to gain from raising concerns about the looming working-class healthcare cliff or promoting Medicare's relative success in reining in provider costs while delivering better access to enrollees. On average, private insurers pay 25% more than Medicare for physician services and 30% more for hospital care. And many members of Congress are equally fixated on jeopardizing Medicare's guarantee of health security at the expense of meaningful reductions in real health care costs. And amid all this talk of prudent spending on social programs, House Republicans refuse to let Medicare negotiate prices with drug companies. They would rather have Americans continue to subsidize the drugs of the French and the Germans, whose governments negotiate prices to protect their citizens, than concede that the U.S. government should negotiate rates to help address our nation's health care cost crisis. How does that make any sense in the season of the fiscal cliff? And on both the health care and deficit fronts, Americans would be better off if Congress did not take direction from CEOs who are legally required to put their shareholders' interests above those of the American people. And lawmakers need to build on the Affordable Care Act and have Medicare lead the way in reforming and strengthening our health care system through innovations that will improve our payment and delivery systems. They need to support reforms that promote better care, eliminate waste and inefficiencies, and enhance accountability and fair pricing. Across the board, solutions such as rationalizing health care prices, setting reasonable rates for all health care products and services throughout our health care system would actually rein in overall costs, and offering working people, a public insurance option like Medicare to drive competition in the commercial market is, as lawmakers consider during the health care reform debates, also would bring down costs. And these are the issues we should be debating when we focus on the cost and value of Medicare. These reforms could mean healthy insurance losses also mean a stronger long-term economy and put us on a path to a sustainable healthcare system, and we should be pressing Congress to focus on them. Our lives depend on it. I think that, you know, it's just excessive greed, folks. I mean, excessive freaking greed. I mean, when a 15-minute doctor's appointment can cost you $250, that's kind of tough. Even if you do have insurance, you know, that's fine, but it's costing the insurance company $250. I don't know. I mean, I just think there's a lot of excess in our health system, and it's not so much the Medicare. They're picking up the tab, but I should say we are. Why should it go to pad the pockets of these large insurance companies when we don't even need these damn insurance companies? I thought this was kind of an interesting article, kind of getting off the union path, but I think it's interesting that, you know, I make such a point of tomorrow, I'm not sure. But Christmas is an ancient celebration of light, with many gods born on December 25th. Interesting. but probably the most repulsive genociders in the world are the Israelis. I mean, my God, they have no conscience now. This article, anti-war blog, states that dehydrating the Palestinian people, by John Glazer. An editorial from Haaretz explains how Israel is destroying the water reserves of the Palestinians in the West Bank as part of an intentional policy to ethnically cleanse the occupied territories and thus make it easier to annex these areas to Israel. Since the beginning of the year, Israel has destroyed 35 rainwater cisterns used by Palestinian communities, 20 of them in the area of Hebron and southern Hebron Hills. In 2011, Israel destroyed 15 cisterns and the preceding 18 months. Here's the communities whose cisterns were destroyed a short distance from settlements and unauthorized outposts that enjoy a regular water supply. At the same opportunity, the civil administration almost always destroys Palestinian tents, animal pens, and food storage facilities, leaving Palestinian communities disconnected from infrastructure, declaring large areas as firing zones, and destroying cisterns are part of the intentional policy since the early 1970s. The goal is to leave as few Palestinians as possible in the majority of the West Bank and today's Area C under Israeli civil and military control to expedite Jewish settlement and thus make it easier to annex these areas to Israel. The European Union opposes Israel's policies in Area C, which the EU believes sabotages the two-state solution. It also bases its position on international law, which prohibits the demolition of structures that would leave a protected population without food and water and result in their forced dislocation, and basic moral principles, as well as avoiding other head-on collisions with our friends, requires that Israel cease and desist from destroying cisterns that are essentially for the existence of dozens of Palestinian communities. Deliberately driving this civilian population of food and water is only one part of the Israeli strategy to smoke out the Palestinian people. The rate at which Israel is demolishing Palestinian homes and building up Israeli settlements in their place is greater now than ever before. And this is the type of cruel policy that has been unilaterally supported by the United States for decades and is currently being abetted by unprecedented rates of U.S. economic, military, and diplomatic aid. And my God, if that doesn't turn you sick, I don't know what will. I just don't. You know, I just don't. And I'll speak out of this till I die. You know, the unjust tactics and the genocidal tactics of Israel are just pathetic and abhorrent. They're just horrid. Frightening article. Banning
dropped from U.S. school circulation. U.S. school curriculum. Schools in America are to drop classic books such as Harper Lee's To Kill a Mockingbird, J.D. Salinger's Catcher in the Rye, from their curriculum in favor of informational texts. American literature classics are to be replaced by insulation manuals and plant inventories in U.S. classrooms by 2014. A new school curriculum, which will affect 46 out of 50 states, will make it compulsory for at least 70% of books studied to be nonfiction in an effort to read to ready pupils for the workplace. Dominant social theme, telling stories, is so last year. Fahrenheit 451, and other books about censorship, got it wrong. The powers that be don't want to ban books. They want to ban stories. This is the inescapable conclusion for those of us who believe in directed history. Over the past decade of covering the world for various proprietary blogs, it becomes clear to us that most human events are manipulated by a small sociopathic elite that controls central banking around the world. And whether such control exists in previous millennia, we are not in a position to say, but it would be our perspective avoiding discussion of past civilizations that the overt control of money power has been growing, not diminishing, of late. And, of course, perhaps these things go in cycles. In that case, it is our misfortune to live at the very apex of one such cycle, and our good fortune to see, thanks to the Internet Reformation, that it is ending. How do we know it is ending? Because the top elites are increasingly turning to the bluntest weapons in their fight to maintain power: economic depression, military conflict, and authoritarian democracy are all modern tools of repression and control, and the idea is to create world government, and nothing is to stop that progression. By far, the most ubiquitous method of control and persuasion is what we call the dominant social theme. This is usually a scarcity-based meme disseminated by the police power elite via its control think tanks, media, and universities, and then acted on via its globalist facilities and political methodologies. Scarcity-based memes are stories aimed at the middle class and designed to frighten people into giving up wealth and power to specially designed international institutions. Food, water, energy scarcity, along with overpopulation and various military terrorist threats, are the famous tools of the top elites. None of the decimated tales are true. But it doesn't matter whether they are true or not. The propagation and saturation of these stories, fables, are most important to the narrative that the elites want to establish. The chief narrative is that of the worlds of the small world. The world is to be seen as inevitably becoming one. It is an ineluctable ascension to be desired and nurtured. It is, of course, for this reason that all talk of previous high civilizations is squelched. Whether they existed or not is not debatable, as the debate will never be held. There is only one civilization. It was launched 5,000 years ago, and world government will be its crowning glory. This is the story. This is the narrative. There cannot be any other, and it is not enough for the elites to control the conversation. Now, apparently, they want to control the storyline as well. Of course, one could argue that with books like Catcher in the Rye, they control the storyline anyway. But apparently, informal control was not enough. Now the control is to be formalized. If stories had to be written, they will be written by approved authors. If they are to be read, it will be within a predetermined cordon sanitaire. And there are to no other gods but the gods of the single story. The God of the single story. The one, the single, all-encompassing plot line leading inevitably towards a gaily decorated single word with one ruling elite authority. After which, from what we can tell, genocide will begin in earnest. And here's more from the RT article. The books such as J.D. Salinger's Clatcher in the Rye and Hartley Harvey's A Mockingbird will be Harper Lee's To Kill a Mockingbird will be replaced by informal text approved by the Common Core standards, state standards. Suggested nonfiction texts included recommended levels of insulation by the U.S. Department of Protection Agency and the invasive plant inventory by California's Invasive Plant Council. And the new educational standards have the backing of the influential National Governors Association and the Council of State Chief State School Officers, and are being part-funded by a grant from the Bill and Melinda Chase Foundation. Oh, God, you know, the Gates Foundation is in this, too. You know eugenics is involved. Supporters of the directive argue that it will help pupils develop an ability to write concisely and factually, which will be more useful in the workplace than a knowledge of Shakespeare. Poor Bill Gates, a man who once dreamt of controlling his own $100 billion fortune, he was attacked by the U.S. government over a punitive monopoly and then stripped of control of his resources and even his professional aspirations by a banking elite that will not tolerate any other monopoly control but its own. This is the reason its button man, Warren Buffett, has been going from wealthy individual like a honeybee, seeking to sip the sweetest nectar of their vast good fortune by suggesting full-scale donations to charities he controls. It is not an emosterni exercise, but one of confiscation. Top elite controls trillions, but mere billionaires are not to be allowed. They must give back to the community, you see, in the brave new world of the elite narrative. A mere billionaire is nothing but the lowliest peon, someone to be inefficiently reduced to penury. He or she is not to leave funds to family, but instead to worthy charities and reputable causes. This is what Bill Gates now confronts. After building one of the most successful companies in the world, he now finds himself denuded of his fortune while his name is attached to the blackest kind of medical engineering via vaccinations and now, if this article is correct, the initiation of purposeful illiteracy. It is ever thus these days. Cross the top elites and they will effectively strip you of your resources and then blacken your name by association. Excuse me for coughing there. They do this by manipulating the socio-political and economic narrative. This is why storytellers are in such demand and why their ability to tell a convincing story is a ticket to wealth, fame, and power in the modern day. It is why such tales have ever more strictly controlled as well, and copyrights and other legal engineering is brought to bear to ensure that the narratives produced and disseminated are the approved ones. It is for this reason that what we call the Internet Reformation has been such a setback to the power elite. The carefully crafted universe that has descended on the world like a gigantic bubble has been pricked, and it has collapsed. And truth has leaked in. We try to purvey some of that truth every day, and so do others. We would even argue a critical mass has been reached, and there is nothing much the elites can do to control the narrative anymore. They are trying to, of course, but as happened with the Gutenberg Press, Once the truth emerged, it tends to sweep the field. It must be a awakening nightmare for the top elites. Much of the progress of the past century has been undone. Amemis have been exposed, and promotions have been capsized. Terror and intimidation are going to have to be substituted for mind control and promotional suasion. And, of course, censorship, too. The narratives of modern civilization are now seen as too powerful to be left in the hands of amateurs. And it's kind of pitiful, actually. It has no chance of working. Tale-telling is as powerful a drive as sex or hunger. It cannot be controlled by regulation or a change in curriculum. It is a testimony to their desperation and a further affirmation of power of the Internet Reformation. And that's that was a good article, I thought. It was from the Daily Bell. excuse me. I got another few minutes left. Let's see what I can come up with here.
Transit officials
pressed forward with their plans last month and announced the installation of an audio recording system on 10 public buses. And the bus plans to roll out the system on at least 340 additional buses. Now, tell me, I'm sure this was the most wanted program, right, by people in bus routes. I kind of doubt it. But anyway, that's tonight's show. I hope you, thanks for joining me. And hope you join me tomorrow night. I should have something interesting to talk to you about. And, in the meantime, say goodnight to you, and sorry Lila couldn't be with me the last of this week, but she will be with me next week. So goodnight, everyone, and have a pleasant evening.